Today's going to be a little different than last week. It's a little bit more historical today. And really what we're doing today is going to set up necessary background for the next few weeks, because we're moving into the Greek period, the Hellenistic period. This is the 2nd and 1st centuries BC. And this is the period that we really know the most about, and that's really most relevant for our understanding of the life of Jesus and the events of the New Testament. And I know a lot more about this period, so I'm happy to be out of the other stuff. I feel much more comfortable here in this period of time. This is also the time period, as you'll see, when most of those strange books that we've looked at were written, the apocryphal books, the pseudepigraphal books. Most of the Dead Sea Scrolls were written in this period. So a lot of the literature that we've been referring to comes from this period. Well, let's get started. The Persians were a very successful empire, as we discussed, but they were not impervious. In the 4th century, there was a small kingdom actually north of Greece called Macedonia. Still have a country, Macedonia, today. We kind of conflate these, but if you are a Greek or a Macedonian, you are very aware of the differences, kind of like Oklahomans and Texans are very aware of the differences between those two states. But somebody from New Jersey just thinks it's all a big, you know, deserty blob. Well, the Macedonians were the Oklahoma of the ancient world. They were kind of looked down upon. They were the underdogs. The Greeks were the high cultured, and that goes all the way back, the people with the philosophy and the great art. And the Macedonians were the backwater, the barbarians. But one thing the Macedonians were good at is they developed some pretty sophisticated military technology, particularly this one man named Philip, who was the king of Macedon. This barbarian king, Philip, developing this particular military technique called the phalanx. Some of you may be familiar with this, military history buffs. The phalanx is a really impressive weapon of war. 9,000 men, 16 by 16, and you can kind of see they have these incredibly long spears. And they just move forward with these long spears, and no one can get to them. The Romans will later improve on this with a giant shield, and so they essentially become a moving tank of human beings, or maybe more like a hedgehog. But it was a very effective military technique, and Philip was able to take all of Greece. So the barbarians are over the high-cultured people. And Philip aspires to do more, but before he can do more, he dies, as often happens, and was succeeded by his son, Alexander the Macedon, who we know mostly as Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great inherited his father's kingdom when he was only 20 years old, which is really pretty hard to believe. Now, Alexander was unusual because he benefited from the best of Greek culture. His father brought in one of the most famous Greek philosophers to be Alexander's private tutor. You might be familiar with Aristotle. Aristotle was Alexander's tutor. And Alexander grew up loving Greek culture, thinking Greek culture was the pinnacle of human achievement. And so when Alexander begins to look on the horizon, following in his father's footsteps, he thinks of his own conquest as a way of spreading Greek culture. We would call him a missionary of Greek culture. That's how much he loved it. The Greek gods, the Greek philosophy, the Greek art. And so he began in a fairly small way. He brought 40,000 troops across the Dardanelles Strait into what we now call Turkey. And there were some Greek cities there along the coast, which were under Persian rule. And so he thought that he would just liberate these cities. And he did pretty easily. The Persian defenses were low. They were sort of lackadaisical. This period. And Alexander easily takes back all of these cities, and the people hail him as a liberator. You may remember that we saw Cyrus was successful because he portrayed himself as a liberator from the Babylonians. Now Alexander is the liberator from the Persians. Well, he's got his 40,000 troops. They're already in Turkey. So he just sort of keeps going without much of a plan. And the turning point in all this happens in the year 332 in November, called the Battle of Issus. Not that Issus. This is a Greek city in modern Turkey, really close to where Paul the Apostle's from. That's Tarsus right here. So really close to where Paul would later be born. So you can see he starts up here, the Dardanelles, he moves down here. And at this point, he's more or less toppled the Persian Empire. He fights Darius III, who's the Persian emperor. He defeats him. Darius runs back home, but really, it's like D-Day. The war is not over, but in some sense, the war is already over. He takes his armies down to Egypt, where he spends several years, captures all of Egypt, and then moves back up into what we now call, well, this is Iraq, Syria, Iraq. And then he eventually makes it to Persepolis, the Persian capital, and finishes off the Persian Empire at this point. He becomes the heir to the great Persian Empire, and ultimately his kingdom spreads all the way from Macedonia, right here, and there's Greeks, all the way to Afghanistan and India. And he did all of this within a couple of years as a 20-something. So, puts most of us to shame. Anybody have anything to add about Alexander the Great? I know that some of you have read about this stuff and are interested in things.
Did he put in place a road system connecting these countries?
The Persians did that more. The Persians put the roads. Alexander, as we'll see, was not an infrastructure guy. The Persians had been. The Romans are definitely going to be infrastructure people. Alexander's important for culture. He's a culture guy. We might call this soft imperialism. But we'll come to that. So not so much on the roads. Actually, he's primarily a conqueror. He'll die by the time he's 30 or so. And we'll see in just a minute, other people will rule these lands, not Alexander himself. Okay. We know about Alexander from a lot of historical sources, but one of the sources that tells us a little bit about Alexander is First Maccabees, and I'll come back to Maccabees. It's an important source for this time period. Let me just read this little bit introducing Alexander to us. After Alexander, son of Philip the Macedonian, who came from the land of Kittim, this is a word that the Judeans like to use for pretty much people out there, the Kittim, the non-Jews. He had defeated King Darius of the Persians and the Medes. He succeeded him as king. He had previously become king of Greece. He fought many battles, conquered strongholds, put to death the kings of the earth. He advanced to the ends of the earth and plundered many nations. When the earth became quiet before him, that's pretty impressive, he was exalted, and his heart was lifted up. He gathered a very strong army and ruled over countries, nations, and princes, and they became tributary to him. Now keep your eye on this phrase right here, his heart was lifted up. This will be important in a moment. So this passage comes from a book called 1 Maccabees. 1 Maccabees is one of two books of the Maccabees, written by different authors at different times, but same time period. It's written around the 2nd century, and it's probably written by someone working for a group called the Hasmoneans. And we'll come to the Hasmoneans later, but you know the Hasmoneans because Herod the Great is the last of the Hasmoneans. So this is the line that will eventually become Herod and his sons in the time of Jesus. They're rulers in this time period. So someone working for the Hasmonean and expresses Hasmonean interest. We'll talk about the Hasmoneans in a couple weeks. Maccabees is a history of this time period. It was originally written in Hebrew. It was translated into Greek pretty soon after, and we've lost the Hebrew. All we have left is the Greek version. This was considered part of the Bible by all Christians for a long time. Today, you can only find it in Catholic, Orthodox, and Eastern Orthodox Bibles. Most Protestant Bibles don't have it in there. But it was universally accepted. The earliest Bibles that we have with tables of contents, they all have the Maccabees in there. So early Christians really appreciated this book and thought it was beneficial. However, they understood its inspiration, not exactly clear. But they put it in their Bible. The history that it tells is about a man named Matthias and his five sons and how they delivered Israel from Hellenism. And I'm saving that great story for next week because I want to spend the whole class on the Maccabean Revolt. Not only because it's intrinsically worth talking about, an exciting, swashbuckling story, but also because it's one of the single most important things from the intertestamental period to understand the New Testament. It's a really important setting up the New Testament. And as you can see, it's the stories of these Maccabean heroes which inspire little Jewish boys for hundreds of years. It's basically a David and Goliath story of little Israel beating back the big bad empire. It inspires thousands and thousands of people to die trying to beat the next big bad empire, the Romans, but nevertheless, it was very influential. And for early Christians as well. As I already said, these texts contain some of the first stories of the martyrs. And, of course, Christians will really value those martyr stories and their own struggles against the empire. Questions or thoughts about the Books of Maccabees? Yeah.
This Hellenistic threat.
Yeah.
Was that within the Jewish community? Or were there help?
Yes.
Some of them had sort of converted over to Hellenism.
Yeah, you could say it like that.
Picked up certain...
Mm-hmm.
And so... They were liberal Jews, and then there were the Jews that were more straight line.
Yeah. And this is the conservative viewpoint.
Okay.
That this history is coming from the straight line, as you say. Okay. Yeah. We'll talk more about this.
Okay.
This right here. Actually, by the end of tonight, we'll have set up this conflict that we'll spend next week thinking through.
Okay.
Yeah, you're right. You're on the right track. Yeah.
Yeah, my understanding is that even though... Alexander was not big on infrastructure as in roads. He did go into cities, build Greek temples, gymnasiums, all this kind of stuff. And the Greeks had a habit of doing their gymnastics in the nude.
Hey, don't spoil it for us, Dan. Yes, that's what we'll get to by the end of that. You're right.
Did you have areas that he had taken over? Is there a certain area that he lived in all of that?
Alexander?
Yes, sir.
He ended up in... I'll say a little bit more about that. The short answer is no. He basically moved from city to city, and then he died. He got sick and died. Yeah. So he never really got to rule over anything. He was the conqueror. It's his generals that are going to do the ruling. Let me say what Hellenism is. And we'll keep exploring it, but some easy definition. The word Hellen is simply the Greek word for itself, for Greece, Hellene. And so Hellenism could be understood as like Greekism. But it's not just Greekism, and this is important to understand, is that Hellenism is a fusion of Greek culture and Eastern culture. So Alexander the Great began his conquest with this great zeal for Greek culture. But what happened was, as he moved into the East, he started falling in love with Eastern culture. I mean, he's 20s, right? He doesn't know what's going on. So he goes to Egypt, and he's blown away by Egyptian culture, by their gods, and by their rituals, and by their traditions. And he kind of lives it up as an Egyptian for a little while. And what's happening is he's absorbing the best of Egyptian culture. And then he leaves and he moves up into Persia. And he falls in love with Persian culture. We'll see in just a minute, he marries a Persian woman, and he makes all of his generals marry Persian women in this gigantic wedding ceremony. He continues to absorb the best of all the things that he encounters. So, Hellenism is not pure Greek culture, as if there were ever a pure culture, right? But it's a mixture, an amalgamation of Greek and Eastern influences, Greek and Persian influences in particular, but also Egyptian stuff mixed in. Now, what's happening here is the development of what we would call cosmopolitanism. A truly global culture is emerging from this conquest. It looks like he's simply imposing his people's culture on these other places, but what's really happening is this new thing is growing up. And it's this cosmopolitan culture which is really going to influence Christianity, which is going to be the first truly cosmopolitan religion. Christianity is not the religion of a people or a place, but it's a religion for all people in all places. What's paving the way for that? It's this Hellenistic culture. So this is really, really important concept and movement in history, Hellenistic movement. The other really important part for our story is this is where Greek comes from. He does spread the Greek language as he goes. He makes Greek the bureaucratic language, the lingua franca of his new empire. Now, this is not the pure Greek of the real Greeks, but this is the basic vulgar Koine Greek of people like Philip and Alexander, Macedonians, right? Koine Greek, as many of you know, is the language that the New Testament was written in. It's the language that the Old Testament was translated into as the Septuagint. It's the language that the early Christians wrote in and spoke. It's a language that Jesus himself likely spoke, at least somewhat. We skipped over a step in this language process. Of course, ancient Israel spoke Hebrew. Hebrew sort of died out after the exile, and Aramaic became the dominant spoken language. Aramaic is a form of Hebrew, but it's not Hebrew. So people began speaking Aramaic in the Persian period. They continued to write in Hebrew. We just said 1 Maccabees is written in Hebrew by people that probably spoke Aramaic. It's with the transition into Greek rule that they pick up Greek. And so in the first century, in Jesus' day, it would be a situation sort of like El Paso, where we've got some Aramaic and we've got some Greek. Greek's like the English language, where the people at the DMV speak it, you need to get along. Aramaic would be the taco stand language, right, where it's like a lot of people still speak it, kind of common. Does that make sense? Jesus is born into a pretty multicultural place. We'll come say more about that in just a minute. Question about these language transitions?
So it's a dialect, it's a whole new language that they just shifted their culture that they were not going to speak Hebrew anymore?
Aramaic is the bureaucratic language of the Persian. Well, it's a complicated story. It's the bureaucratic language of the Babylonian Empire. The Persians kept it, even though it wasn't their language, because everything was already in Aramaic. So they're both Semitic languages, Aramaic and Hebrew, but they're different languages. Yeah. If you can read Hebrew, you can kind of get along in Aramaic, okay? Anybody read Aramaic in here? Study Aramaic?
No.
Okay. They offer it up, see, but I don't offer it up. Yeah.
So somebody was, at this time when Aramaic was starting to being or spoken a lot more, if they was reading from a Greek text, would they be verbalizing it in Aramaic or Greek?
The opposite, actually. We'll talk more about this because I want to say more about the translation of the Bible into Greek. That's really important for understanding Christianity. Probably what would have happened is they would have had a Hebrew version. And if you've been in a mission work situation, you might have encountered something like this. And they would probably read a bit of it in Hebrew, and then they translate it on the spot. But they weren't just translating word for word, they were also trying to make sense of it. and this is called Targum, and it's a sort of interpretive translation. So we have a lot of these Targums in the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's one place we have them. And it's interesting because it reflects the understanding of the people at the time, right? So it's sort of like the Living Bible would be a great example of Targum. Or the Message is an even better example of the Targum. It's a paraphrase to help make sense to people. And so that actually happened in all kinds. It happened from Hebrew to Greek when the Greek Bible was taught in Latin-speaking places. It was a Latin Targum, right? So, Joe?
When you say there was a widespread adoption, was Alexander the force behind that? Or was it just something that happened?
There was a force behind it. Alexander, again, did not have much time to administer the empire himself. It will be the people following him. Alexander sets this policy in place, and it's his generals that will carry it out, and the kings that come later. We'll see that it's enforced more heavily in some places than others, which is what's going to lead us to the problem that somebody already mentioned, the conflict with Hellenism. So,
but Aristotle didn't speak Koine Greek.
Oh, no.
It would have been pure Greek.
Attic Greek. There's several Greek dialects, yeah. Ionic Greek, Attic Greek, yeah. Doric Greek, Homeric Greek before that, yeah.
Yeah. So it's our column for everyone.
Mention that. Another part of Hellenism that's good to know about is that there was a lot of Greek colonies that sprang up all around the world. And this is another place where that cultural fusion happens, mostly in Asia and Africa. So it would basically be a city just grows up that wasn't there before, and it's completely populated by Greeks, Greek speakers, ethnic Greeks. You might still hang around if you're just an ordinary Syrian or Libyan or wherever this is, but you're going to be a second-class citizen in the Greek colony. Now, the most famous of these is Alexandria. That's right here. This is the Nile Delta, of course, right? So the Sinai Peninsula. Alexandria was built by Alexander and named after Alexander. And if you're familiar with classic culture, you know that the city of Alexandria was known as the home of some of the wonders of the world. It had the greatest library in the ancient world. It had like the Harvard and Yale of the ancient world. It was a city of learning. We're going to come back to Alexandria in a little while, a couple weeks, when we think about the intellectual implications of Hellenism. But right now, just know that they built this city in Egypt as a Greek city. If you walk through the streets, you'd see Greek columns, Greek architecture. It would look and feel like a Greek city plopped down in the middle of Egypt. Now, closer to home for us is the Decapolis. Some of you may be familiar with this word, Decapolis, from the Gospels. It's mentioned in Mark 5. It's mentioned in various places. And the Decapolis, in Greek, literally the 10 cities, and it varied. These cities weren't all built at the same time, but over the course of a century or so, these 10 cities were built basically just a little bit to the east of Galilee and Samaria. So there's the Decapolis. There's Judea and Jerusalem. Here's where Jesus grew up, right here. Now, the Decapolis were, again, Greek cities with Greek architecture plopped down in the middle of Palestine. And within the city, Greek culture was elevated and celebrated. There were temples. There were the gymnasium that we'll talk about in just a minute. But, of course, there are Jewish people and other ethnicities all around. And they can't help but have some blending, which is what happens over the course of about 250 years. Some blending of culture. Now, one interesting thing that you may or may not know is Nazareth, where Jesus grew up, is actually right next door to one of these cities. Which one? Oh, I thought you said it. Sepphoris. Sepphoris was one of these Greek towns. Strangely, even though it's only about 5 miles from Nazareth, this city never comes up in the Gospels. But you know what? Nazareth is just a little village. And if Jesus and his family wanted work, especially construction work, where do you think they would have gone? Sepphoris, which was a prosperous town where they're always building those high-rise apartments, right? And Jesus and Joseph probably made the five-mile walk into Sepphoris on a regular basis and worked construction jobs there, like everyone else in the village. Which meant, did Jesus speak Greek? Well, he might have had to get along in some Greek to be able to communicate with the people in the city, right? It's even possible that that Torah scroll, well, that Isaiah scroll that he read in the synagogue was a Greek Isaiah scroll. That's quite possible. We don't know. So Jesus was in contact with this Greek culture, with these cities that were established in this period. And it would be nice to know more. But we do know enough to say that Jesus' world was a pluralistic world, where cultures were meeting, cultures were in tension. And that should comfort us a little bit, because we live in a world of multicultures and not always getting along like we would like, trying to navigate, figure things out. Language issues are still with us, right? We're still arguing about what language to speak and who should speak what, where the borders are. These problems go all the way back. They go all the way back. Questions about these colonies? Or this cultural mixture?
So were they by and large resentful of this culture, or these Greeks, or was everybody just kind of doing their own thing?
It depended, right? Sometimes people in El Paso get along, and sometimes they don't get along, right? The Greeks thought that the Jewish people were... they thought circumcision was a really disgusting, barbaric practice. They thought it was bodily abuse. Sort of like a lot of Westerners think about female circumcision in North Africa. Like, that's just culturally atrocious, that's inappropriate, right? That's how the Greeks would have viewed the Jews of their day. But you can't help but think that there were also some things they appreciated and learned. Maybe they picked up hummus. I don't know. And it worked the other way too, right? For the Jews, Greeks are idolaters. In the New Testament, the word Gentile is synonymous with sinner. It's like if you're born Gentile, you're just automatically a sinner and an idol worshiper and all this. So they would have resented that. At the same time, you can't help but think that maybe they admired the architecture, or there was some things that they learned to admire. And so there's the bit of merging, as just happens inevitably.
Were these planned communities? Were they Greeks sent out these groups of people to do this, or what drove them to leave to establish towns in foreign countries?
Now that's a great question, and I can't answer that. This is how it works. Sometimes in the ancient world, so you might have an entrepreneur who wants to start a city. That can happen. Sometimes you also have the government setting aside a piece of land for veterans or for civil servants. So it's kind of like their retirement package. We capture this bit of land, and we give you a piece of it right at the center of the city. So that's how a lot of these colonies started, as military, veteran colonies, or people in the civil service. It can also be, just like in more modern times, a place to start fresh. So you might attract prisoners or people with bad names or running away from credit. You get those kind of people in there too. They are planned architecturally in that they have a Greek temple, they have a gymnasium, and certain sorts of important things for Greek cities to have. Dan?
I was going to say a lot of them have an amphitheater.
Yeah, right.
All have amphitheaters.
For entertainment. Baths were pretty common, yeah. So the word for these cities is polis, as in metropolis, right? And polis is just a Greek word for city. It's also where we get the word politic from, polis. It's what we need to do as a city. And so these polis were springing up all over. Let me talk about kingship for just a minute. So as Alexander's moving through, especially through Egypt and Persia, One of the things that he's really beginning to appreciate is their worship of kings. So Macedonian culture is kind of what you would expect, like a staunch military culture. Think about the Spartans. No frills, right? You don't conquer the world with frills. And so Philip, Alexander's father, was fairly straight-laced. Alexander certainly began his life that way. But when he got to Egypt, particularly, the people welcomed him as Pharaoh, as the son of Ra, the son of Zeus, the son of God. And he liked this. And he let them put the Pharaoh's clothes on him. In fact, there's an image of Alexander dressed as Pharaoh right there. And he played the part of Pharaoh, son of Ra. He let them offer sacrifices to him as if to the god. His soldiers pull him out of there before things go too far because they don't like this direction. But as they go into Persia, it only gets worse. If anything, the Persian kings are more flamboyant. If you think about that movie 300, the way the Persian king Xerxes is depicted, all earrings and flowing gowns, and very opulent. Well, the Persians thought of their kings also as divine beings. And so once he takes over Persia, they begin treating him again like a god. And he likes this. He makes his soldiers bow down when they come before him, right? These are soldiers, right? They fought together for years. Now you have to bow down. He made them blow kisses, as was the Persian custom. Blow kisses. Now you can see that they're not going to put up with this for very long. In fact, Alexander intended to march on into India. That was his plan. He's like, we've come this far, let's keep going. And they actually cut him off. Like, this has gotten too weird already. Who knows what's over there in India? We're just going to stay. And that's when he died. So he thought of himself as divine. Now, after he dies and his generals take over the land, they're going to do away with a lot of this because they don't like it. A lot of his new policies, a lot of the Persian stuff, most of them divorce their Persian wives as soon as he dies. They're like, forget this. We're Macedonians, right? One thing that almost all of his successors hang on to is the idea of divine kingship. They also like being treated like gods in the places that they end up ruling. Why will this be important? Because this idea will also be absorbed by the Romans, and Caesar Augustus will mint his coins as Caesar Augustus, Huios Deus, son of God. And so when Jesus comes on the scene and starts saying, well, he doesn't say it very much, when people say it about him, son of God, they're not thinking religion, because everyone in Israel is a son of God. We're all the Benoi Elohim. When they hear son of God, what do they think of?
King James.
They think of Alexander the Great. They think of Caesar. Now, son of God was a political phrase, and it starts here in this Hellenistic merger of cultures. Let me continue the narrative with Maccabees. It's a good guide. After Alexander fell sick and perceived that he was dying, so he summoned his most honored officers who had been brought up with him from youth, and he divided his kingdom among them while he was still alive. And after Alexander had reigned 12 years, he died. So 32 years old, and that's it. It's said, by the way, that Alexander, once he got to India, sat on a tree stump and wept because he said there's no more world to conquer. It's just terrible. So his officers began to rule each in their own place. They all put on crowns after his death, and so did their descendants after them for many years. They caused many evils on the earth. So think of that big empire that I just showed you sliced up into quarters, and that's more or less what you get. Now, the real history is a little bit more complicated. You can see that there are initially five rulers. One of these gets knocked out pretty quickly and absorbed by another one. And so there are these, the orange one gets absorbed by the green one, which we'll see in just a minute. And we're not concerned about who's in charge here. What we are concerned about is the green and the purple, because here's Israel. And guess who it's stuck between? Remember, for most of their history, Israel is caught between Egypt and Assyria. A lot of the Old Testament is just Egypt or Assyria, Egypt or Assyria. Same geography, different bosses, right? Now there are two Greek bosses, one in Egypt, one in the former land of Assyria. The Egyptian kingdom was ruled by a general named Ptolemy, and so it's sometimes called the Ptolemaic kingdom. And the Ptolemaic kings reigned all the way up until the Roman period in 30 BC. Anybody know who the last Ptolemy was? Yeah?
Cleopatra
was the last one. Yep. And she killed herself. The Macedonians followed Alexander's practice of becoming pharaohs. And one of the interesting things was they completely adopted Egyptian traditions. They intermarried with the Egyptians. They even adopted this really bizarre practice of only marrying their sisters, their biological sisters. That was the pharaonic practice. To the point where, after a few generations, no one really knew they were Greek anymore. They were fully integrated. Now, everyone spoke Greek, but culturally, it still looked pretty much Egyptian. Hieroglyphs, pyramids, all that stuff is still there. The important thing to know about the Ptolemies, one, they were pretty hands-off with the people that they ruled. They wanted the taxes, and they weren't concerned about much else. They were in a constant battle with the kingdom just to the north of them, the Seleucids. That's the other big one. And again, it's Palestine, right in the middle, where the major highway runs that both of them are wanting to get, both for military reasons, military strategy, also for economic reasons. You want control of the highway. The Ptolemaic kingdom ruled Judah until about the year 200. It was a constant back and forth. We don't really know much about the period between 300 and 200. We're kind of skipping over that, if you'll notice. That was a period characterized by the Syrian Wars, so back and forth between these two kingdoms. And little Judah is just caught in between. And they're kind of like a toy boat on the waves of a storm. They're just riding out this century. So we don't know very much. Seemingly not much is happening except they're hanging on for 100 years or so. One thing that's developing, we don't have to worry too much about this story. The family that ruled Judea was called the Tobiad family, like Tobias. We actually hear about one of these people in Nehemiah. So it's the same people from Nehemiah. They're kind of like local warlords, not the right word. Sheikh might be the better word. They rule this area. This family does. And one of them, Joseph Tobias, he was the nephew of the high priest. The high priest, they're all in politics, right? The high priest favors the north and refuses to pay a fine to the south. This gets Judah in some trouble because they're not paying their fines. So Joseph Tobias steps in and says, oh, we're very sorry. Don't worry about my uncle, the high priest. Here's the money. Here's a little extra. Why don't you just let me be in charge of taxes? Now, this is a shrewd business move because what it means is Joseph and his family now have the taxing rights to this whole region. And how are they going to extract those taxes?
Matthew.
Yeah, Matthew, yeah.
I think it wasn't the government who was getting the tax. They kind of hire private companies.
Yes. It's privatized taxation. And, yeah, of course, who pays the private company? Nobody. They just skim off. Right. They take their own tax. The Ptolemies are still getting their money, so it is government tax. All the Ptolemies care is that that check comes in every month, right? But whatever it takes for the tax farmers to get the taxes, well, whatever. So, as you can imagine, the Tobiah family grows rich. This is connected to the high priestly family, and you begin to see something of the potential for corruption and scandal with all these people are mixed up, right? Politics, economics, religion, all mixed up. And what's at the heart of it? The temple in Jerusalem. So the Seleucid, there's the little Ptolemaic Empire. The Seleucid Empire, as I said, it inherited all of that former land of Persia and Babylon. But the capital was right here in what we call Syria. It was called Syria back then. The kings of the Seleucid Empire, it's actually pretty simple for us. They almost all had the same name, Antiochus. And if you've read the Bible lately, you've probably seen this word. And you've probably been confused why there's so many cities named Antioch in this region. Well, they were all, it's all like Washington's, right? We've got a state, we've got a city, we've got counties, all Washington's. Same with Antioch in the ancient world. Antioch of Syria, Antioch of Pisidia, blah, blah, blah. They're all named after these Seleucid kings, the Antiochians. So the Seleucids, they took control of Judea in about the year 200. And one thing that's different about the Seleucids, I said that the Ptolemies absorbed Egyptian culture. They kind of left the Hellenistic project behind a little bit. They were Egyptians now. But the Seleucids, of all of the remnants of the empire, they held on to Alexander's vision. They established cities, the polis, more than anyone else. They promoted Greek culture more than anyone else. And another unusual thing is that they were also deeply interested in native culture. So this is kind of a strange juxtaposition. The Ptolemies were very hands-off, send the taxes in, we're happy. But the Seleucids were kind of involved at the local level in the affairs of the different places. They were interested in making sure that every little city had a temple, had a gymnasium, had an amphitheater, had the things that it needed to be a Greek city. And so, you know, they were like grants for this sort of thing. Like, build your amphitheater grant. And these little towns all over were applying for them, right? So absorbing Greek culture. This is a very effective form of imperialism because you don't have to use swords as much. Remember the Assyrians? Their method was to kill everyone. The Babylonians' method was to take captive everyone. The Persians sent everyone back and told them to tell their gods to pray for us. Kind of gave them a modified self-rule. The Greeks are going to run their empire in this hands-off way through their culture. And this is sort of the way that American power worked, at least in the last century, right? Everyone drinks Coca-Cola and wears blue jeans, and America seems like a great... And like, America had a lot of cultural power in the world. It had military power to back up the cultural power, but the cultural power did a lot. Did a lot to do the work. And Dan's gymnasium, the gymnasium. So the Seleucids were interested that each town was equipped with these sorts of amenities. So, how does this affect Jerusalem? And we're going to wrap things up in Jerusalem again. So this is around 175, so soon after the Seleucids have taken back, or have taken Judea for the first time. This is how the narrative of Maccabees continues. See if you can see where their perspective is coming from. Some of the people eagerly went to the king, who authorized them to observe the ordinances of the Gentiles. That's the Greeks. So they built the gymnasium in Jerusalem according to Gentile custom, and removed the marks of circumcision and abandoned the Holy Covenant. They joined with the Gentiles and sold themselves to do evil. So what kind of person do you think is writing this?
someone who wasn't Hellenistic.
Yes. We have the pro-Hellenistic faction, and we have the anti-Hellenistic faction. This is anti-Hellenistic. Now, an interesting fact, this word Hellenism is an ancient word, and it actually looks like this in Greek, more or less. This word came after this word. There was no Judaism until there was Hellenism. Judaism is a self-identity developed in response to Hellenism. Because what are you before the Greeks come along? We're us. We're the people. But when somebody new comes to town, we have to distinguish ourselves. Oh, they're Hellenist. We're Jews. They practice Hellenism. We practice Judaism. Does that make...
Because they're Judah and Samaritan?
Well, it's not so much about the Samaritan distinction. It's this, you're Gentile, but we're Jewish. But this identity of being Jewish, and this whole idea of having a... This is really modern language, right? Religion, it's a modern word and a modern concept. Again, if you're living in the village and you're going to the synagogue, you don't have a name for it, right? It's just what you do, right? It's only when somebody new comes to town that you need a word for it, right? We're just Christians until somebody else comes along, and then we have to get more specific about it. Joe?
I think you mentioned the first lesson. When did the terms Israel and Israelites, remind me of when that disappeared?
The terms themselves never disappeared because they're in the scripture. And so at least symbolically, they're always going to be Israel. That's always there. But Israel as a nation of 12 tribes disappeared 7 centuries or so ago.
Okay.
Yeah, there's really only been Judah for several centuries at this point.
They weren't known as Israelites at all.
These people, no. No, under Persian rule, they were called Yehudites because the region was called Yehud, Judah, Yehud. And at this point, they'd be called Judeans. Yeah. And of course, Jew is just short for Judean.
I was thinking, did that word Hellenism come from Helene, the son of, in the Greek account, the guy who built the ark, it was his son?
Well, and also, you're right. Yeah, and that Greek flood narrative.
The only one with that word Hellenism, it just sounds weird, but I looked that up one time, I think it's what it says.
Yeah, that's right. And Helen of Troy is named, her name comes from that, but you're right. So, what's happened here? Briefly, that story I mentioned a minute ago about Joseph Tobiah, the guy who got the tax farm, his uncle, he was a priest, and that high priest's name was Onias II. We're now in the time of Onias III. Onias was a line of high priests in this period. And Onias III was a conservative. He still liked the Ptolemies to the south. He didn't think that the Seleucids would win. And so this initiated this kind of bidding war for who would have control. And the rulers in Judea were playing off the Ptolemies and the Seleucids against each other. They were bribing officials. And the high priesthood, which had passed down from father to firstborn son, that was the traditional way that it passed down, in this period shifted. A man named Jason comes along, pays the Seleucid king to be the high priest, and he says, if you make me the high priest, I'll promote your interest, Hellenism, and I'll make sure that the bribe increases that we send you every year. Money, religion. So Jason becomes the high priest. Unfortunately, if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. He gets ousted just a few years later by the other team who has a bigger bribe. This, as you can imagine, corrupts the high priesthood, right? People begin to lose faith in the priesthood because they're corrupt. They're doing all these things. One of the things that this priest Jason does, and Jason is what kind of name?
Greek.
Not a Jewish name. Definitely a Greek name. This high priest named Jason agrees to build a gymnasium in Jerusalem. There had not been one. Now, why might the people of Jerusalem be resistant to some of these Greek innovations? Yeah, gymnos, the Greek word for gymnasium. Close your eyes. They worked out naked in the interview. It was only men allowed in there, but they worked out in the nude. So the Greeks, they loved the body, you know, sound mind, sound body. But Eastern people were a little bit more reluctant to show the body. And so the gymnasia around the Eastern part of the world were a little scandalous. Right? People were not sure about that. In Jerusalem, which is a morally conservative society, they were very scandalous. Now, you may have noticed a little line in that bit from Maccabees. Did you see this bit? Remove the marks of circumcision. Anybody know what that might mean?
So to return it out.
They developed a surgery to undo circumcision. It involves stretching the skin of the penis. And just like plastic surgery today, it costs big money, right? The rich kids got to do that. Now, why might you want to undo the marks of circumcision? So you fit in with the other guys. And of course, if you're a business person, where do you think the deals are happening? In the bathhouse, right? It's just like in those mobster movies. We're all in the sauna together. If you want the contract, right, to serve food to the king, you're there in the gymnasium. It's like the golf course, maybe, right? It's where business happens. So Jason's actually doing what we would think of like a smart corporate move for Jerusalem, but then you've got the people picketing and saying, this is not who we are, right? What'll it be next? A temple? And it was kind of next. So I'll leave you with this quote. This is from 2 Maccabees, so it's a slightly different version of some of the same events. And we'll pick back up with this story next week. It's really an exciting story. There was such an extreme of Hellenization and increase in the adoption of foreign ways because of the surpassing wickedness of Jason, they don't like Jason, who was ungodly and not a real high priest at all, that the priests were no longer intent upon their service at the altar. This is great. Despising the sanctuary and neglecting the sacrifices, they hurried to take part in the unlawful proceedings of the wrestling arena. All the high priests are at WWF, not doing the sacrifices in the temple, disdaining the honors prized by their ancestors and putting the highest value upon Greek forms of prestige. You've left the old paths. You're following the new ways. Now, is this the whole story? No. This is one side of the story. If you talk to these priests, it might not actually be as bad as it sounds here, right? We have to be critical readers. But you do see the kind of angst and tension in this period. And it's going to come to a head under one particular ruler, a man named Antiochus IV, who calls himself Epiphanes, which literally means Antiochus the King, God made manifest. A really colorful character with a very high view of himself, and he will come and basically wreck Jewish culture, at least for a little while, and set the stage for a lot of the New Testament stuff. Final thoughts or questions? All right, thanks a lot. Hope to see you back next week. Talk about some revolution.